If you'd like to be making your way to the opening of the book of Joshua, we'll be looking at some of the initial chapters here and spend most of our time here this morning. Before I get into today's lesson, let me say just a word about next Sunday evening. This will be the second in our what's been entitled Salvation Sermons. And what these are just simply very basic gospel sermons that if you have a friend or if you have a neighbor who you would like to hear that message, this is an opportunity where you can invite those people to come. And knowing that nothing I'm going to say is going to be unnecessarily offensive, I'll give it just as it is for someone to hear. And I think that will perhaps put someone on more of an ease to understand that no one's being singled out, no one is going to be embarrassed, and you can have confidence that you'll not be embarrassed either by that. There have been some cards made for that. They're in the back, so I would encourage you to get those. We need to get those out this week. Again, after next Sunday night, they'll be of no use to us, so I hope that we can get those out and have a number of people come. We've also sent invitations to our neighbors around the building. So if you live close, you might check with your neighbors and see if they've received one, maybe start a conversation in that regard also. So I hope we can have a good study next Sunday night with that. For the past several weeks, we have been exploring the Ark of the Covenant. And we've looked at several situations in which God has shared with us different circumstances in which the Ark played a very integral role. If we wanted to talk about this strictly from the number of terms that the ark, or number of times the term ark is used, we're going to find that the most in the Samuel accounts. 1 and 2 Samuel, we'll find the ark being used about 52 times. And then in second place would be Chronicles with about 39 times. And of course, there's some overlap with those. And so we saw how that Hophni Phinehas did not respect the ark. They went, they got it, they brought it out of the most holy place of the tabernacle. It was taken to the battlefield as though it's a good luck charm. It was not. And God showed them that. The ark was captured. A lot of death and destruction. The ark was then taken to the country of the Philistines. They treated it as a victory trophy. It was not. God caused their God to bow before it, beheading their God, so to speak, with his head coming off the statue. We find that sickness and death resulted till they sent it back, and then the men of Beth Shemesh still had not learned the lesson. They looked into the ark that God had said not to do. Death and destruction followed, and it really wasn't until the ark went to Kiriath Jearim, that little Eden, in which it's going to sit for a number of years, that it at least began to gain some of the respect that it deserved. After a period of time, David tried to move the ark to Jerusalem. He did not respect the ark. Death followed because of that until he learned his lesson that God must be glorified. And when he realized that, the ark is then brought to Jerusalem where eventually it will be placed in the temple. This morning, chronologically speaking, we're going to drop back. Long before the events that I just described took place, we have the people of Israel coming into the land of Canaan. And if we're going to keep up with the number of usages, Joshua is going to be in third place with the number of times the term ark is used. And it's going to center primarily around two events, the coming into the land of Canaan, as well as the first battle that took place there. So this morning, I want us to examine these two situations, to look at the ark's role, but to also broaden it out and to understand the lessons that God was seeking to teach his people. One thing that's going to come out very strongly as we look at the people coming into the land of Canaan is that there is going to be a remarkable similarity with the Exodus from the land of Egypt. And I'll point that out as we go through. But yet, as now they're getting ready to take possession of the land, God is ready to deliver them just as he brought them out of the land of Egypt. So let's look at two passages that are going to make this point very clearly to us. Joshua chapter 4, the Lord describes what he's doing here. It says, "For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did at the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. Here Joshua is making the parallel in no uncertain terms. But yet, I want us to note something else in connection with the Exodus. If we think about what the Lord said on the occasion when He brought them out of the land of Exodus, He said in chapter 13 and verse 9, "It shall be a sign on your hand as a memorial between your eyes, that the law of the Lord may be in your mouth, for with a strong hand of the Lord He has brought you out of Egypt." Note here how once again we've got the hand of the Lord playing a very big role. If you'll recall back in one of our first lessons on this topic, we talked about how many times the hand of the Lord is showing up as God is bringing destruction on both Israel and the Philistines. Here God is saying, the way I've given you this land is the same way that I got you out of the land of Egypt. It is by my power. It is by my strong hand. Now, with that in mind, let's take a look at the comparisons between both the Exodus and what's going on here in the book of Joshua. There are going to be some key words that link these two events together. One of them is going to be the description of the water. Book of Joshua chapter 3, as we're discussing the waters of the Jordan, it says the waters coming down from above stood up and rose up in a heap. Very far away. Exact same language we find in Exodus 15:8. As they're singing here the song of the sea following the Exodus, they sang, "At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up, the flood stood up in a heap." We also find that when the people are crossing the Jordan, we're told specifically that the priests bearing the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord commanded Joshua to tell the people according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua, the people passed over in haste. Well, again, we pick up on that as a key term because if you'll remember, when the people of Israel were leaving Egypt, something the Egyptians told them. The Egyptians were urgent with the people to send them out of the land in haste. They said, "We shall all be dead." They were experiencing being on the wrong side of God's power, and they tell the people of Israel, "We want you out quickly." So we find that hasty departure coming in to tie in with their hasty entrance into the land of Canaan. And then one other that we can point out, there's likely several others. But note here in chapter 2, verse 24, they said to Joshua, "Truly the Lord has given all the land into our hands, and also all the inhabitants of the land melt away because of us." In that song of the sea in Exodus 15, there's somewhat of a prophetic message. Listen to what they sang. "Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed, trembling seizes the land of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away." Just as they prophesied all of those years earlier, now the people of Israel are about to experience as the people of Canaan are absolutely terrified of their coming in. One thing that struck me as I was studying out for this lesson is that when you link these two accounts, it's almost like the wilderness wandering never happened. It's almost like God is saying, "I'm going to pick up right here where the story ended earlier, and I'm going to continue it out as though those 40 years are simply a footnote in history," which in a sense they were. Because this is what God intended. God wanted the people to come out of Egypt straight into their land, but because of their rebellion, God had to teach them a lesson, but now that that's taking place and that lesson has been taught, God is saying, "Let's pick up where the Exodus left off." With all of that said, one thing that's going to stand out pretty strikingly in this section of Joshua is that God is giving Joshua the role of leader. And He's going to do that again in a somewhat similar way as He did with the man Moses. As God was leading the people out of the land of Egypt, Moses is the spokesman. And he's got the staff in his hand, sometimes called the staff of God, which is going to be that visible symbol that the power of God is with him as he parts the sea, as the plagues come before that. But now as we get to the entrance into the land of Canaan, it's not going to be a staff that we're going to see most associated with Joshua. Instead, what we're going to find is the Ark of the Covenant. And what God is going to do is to use the Ark of the Covenant as a part of His exaltation of Joshua as the leader of the people going into the land. So let's just take a look at some of the things that we find. If you're here in Joshua, go ahead to chapter 3. And as we look at verse 3, it says, "The command came to the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priest, then you shall set out from your place and follow it." What we need to understand is the centrality of the Ark. It was a visible symbol that God was with this people. It was a visible symbol that as they were going into the land of Canaan, it was not on their own. They were not going to win this by their own strength, but rather because God was with them. And because of that, we see a couple of very familiar things here. First of all, down in verse 5, Joshua is going to tell the people to consecrate yourself. "For tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." Anytime you find that relationship of God and man coming together, a consecration must occur, a cleaning must occur. We talked about that a few weeks ago with the high priest as he went in to the Ark of the Covenant, that there were things that he had to do to be ready. In this case, as the Ark is going to be in their presence and crossing over into the land, they too must be consecrated as well. We find that Joshua says you've got to keep your distance from what's happening. Verse 4, the first part of it, "Therefore you shall be at a distance between you and it about 2,000 cubits in length." There must be a respect, a separateness when God is in your midst. That's what the tabernacle illustrated. That while God was with them and God was giving them this great honor, there was still a certain degree of separation between God and the people. That's what we're seeing demonstrated here also. So Joshua says, you keep your distance. You make sure you're consecrated, but then he tells them, wherever that ark goes, you follow it. If we finish verse 4, he says, "Do not come near it in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before." If we paraphrase, Joshua is saying, you're going to be lost if you don't stick with God. If you don't follow that ark where it's leading, though you are separated from it, you can still find it. You can still be there close to it. And you need to follow. Now, as we look at that, we begin now to see where Joshua becomes associated with this leadership of God. As God has said to be consecrated and to keep your distance and to know the way by following the ark, we're going to find that Joshua begins giving instructions. And so in verse 6, Joshua said to the priest, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people." So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. Who is speaking on behalf of God now? It's Joshua. Joshua is going to be the one who's giving the directions. And then all of that ultimately leading us to verse 7, where the text records the Lord's words, when he said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you." Who is in charge? God. No doubt about it. But God says, "I want the people to understand that I am using you as my spokesman. That I am using you to give the instructions to them." It's an interesting concept because it's both pointing backward and forward. As we think about God's creation of mankind, it was created as a partnership. That God had created the earth and He told mankind, "I want you to keep the earth and to multiply it." And so God has always desired that close relationship with humanity, and we saw it with Moses and we're seeing it again with Joshua. But yet we're also looking forward to a time when that concept of Joshua and the ark will be merged into one, where we will see someone who's coming who is not simply a spokesman for God, but is God who is giving the direction. So, interesting parallels we're seeing, whether we're looking back or forward, with all of these things that are going on as they enter the land of Canaan. One important thing that God does tell them is that you must remember your God. As you're going into the land, I want you not to be distracted by all of these false gods, but to remember who it is who's leading you here. In fact, there will be two terms that he'll use to describe God here. The first one we find in verse 10. Joshua said, "Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you all of these different groups." We see that then in verse 11, he gives a second term for God. And he says, "Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into Jordan." Let's remember what they're about to face. All of these different groups, Hittites, Canaanites, Perizzites, all these different groups were dedicated to paganism. They all had their own concepts of God, and Israel is going to come into association with Baal and Asherah and all of these other false gods. God says, "I want you to understand something. You serve the living God. I'm not a God of stone or wood. I'm not a God who's going to be sat somewhere in a temple. I am the God who is alive. And not only that, I am a God who can say to some people, 'You're out of this land,' while bringing in another group, because I am the God of all of the earth." Those are powerful terms that Joshua is introducing to the people to say, realize exactly who it is that you're serving. And to help in remembering that, there's going to be a command to memorialize this event of the crossing of the Jordan. This is going to be a big event in history, just as the crossing of the Red Sea. And so God tells them this. Here's how I want you to remember it. Giving the instructions to Joshua, Joshua then called the 12 men from the people of Israel, whom he had appointed, a man from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, "Pass on before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, that this may be a sign among you. When your children ask in time to come, 'What do those stones mean to you?' then you shall say to them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it passed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off, so that these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever." God says, "I want you to know, and not only to know, but to let your children know how that the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all of the earth passed before you, cut off those waters so that you could come into this land." What's God doing? God is saying, "I want Israel to remember that I am God." Let me give you an interesting parallel to that. When we go back to the book of Exodus, we run across a passage that maybe on the surface doesn't really seem that it would even be associated with this. But let's put it up here side by side and note a couple of similarities. As God is talking about the high priest and what he's to wear, he says, "You shall take two onyx stones and engrave them on the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on the one stone and the names of the remaining six on the other in the order of their birth. As a jeweler engraves signets, so you shall engrave the two stones with the names of the sons of Israel. You shall enclose them in settings of gold filigree, and you shall set the two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod and stones of remembrance for the sons of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for remembrance." On both occasions, we have stones on the shoulder. In the first case, these stones are going to be brought as Israel will remember God. But yet, as we read the description of the high priest's garments, the stones on the shoulder will be a reminder that God would remember Israel. What's this showing us? It's showing us the covenant. Here is a people who have dedicated themselves to God because here is a God who has dedicated himself to this people. And God is saying, as you go forward and as this ark is going before you, I want you to remember that covenant that I have with you. And to never let that escape the generations that follow. What a good reminder. But let's look at a second example. As we find the people going into the land of Canaan, God prepares them to go to battle. They're standing at the doorsteps of Jericho, one of the walled cities. And God says, I want you to take this city. Once again, we're going to find the ark playing a very pivotal role in all of this. Again, where the people could see it as a reminder of who is in charge of what's going on. As we think about the instructions, likely you remember this. God says, I want you to pass around that city. I want you to go one time around it for 6 days. Then on the seventh day, go seven times. And it's almost like there's a little parade that's going around. And you've got priests, you've got trumpets, you've got men who are in a sense guarding the ark. But right there, squarely in the most prominent place, will be the priest carrying that ark of the covenant. And so what God says is, I want you to understand that when you go into this city, I'm the one who's going to give it to you. But just as he did when they crossed over into the Jordan, he says, I want you to understand, I'm partnering with a leader. And so once again, we know that's Joshua. And God says, I'm going to exalt you and allow you to have this victory. But not before God reminds Joshua of who's truly in charge. You look over just a couple of chapters to chapter 5. Very unusual little story here. As the time for battle is drawing near, verse 13 of chapter 5 says, when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing there before him with a drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no. He says, I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? What this man says should sound very familiar to us. The commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. Here is Joshua's burning bush moment. Here he is in the presence of this theophany where God is now saying, Joshua, though I am exalting you, Joshua, though I am giving you the opportunity to serve me, I am the one who gives the victory. And the reminder of that again in verse 2 of chapter 6, when the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor. I'll give you the victory, and there will be no king who will be a match for you. I am the God of all of the earth. I decide who's on the throne and who's not, and this king will in no way be able to defeat you. And so as we go then down to verse 11, let's note what God says about Joshua. It says, he caused the ark of the Lord to circle the city, going about it once. And they came into the camp, and they spent the night there. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took their place with the ark of the Lord. And the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord walked on. And they blew the trumpets continually, and the armed men were walking before them, and the rear guard was walking after the ark of the Lord while the trumpets blew continually. Joshua is taking his place as the leader of this group. And what we're about to find now is the decreation of Jericho. With God's plan in place, the reminder of who is truly in charge, Joshua endowed with this exaltation from God, they began this very eerie march around the city. Can you imagine? The people of Jericho have heard of this God. They know what He did to the people of Egypt. They're terrified. It says they're shut up within the city. They don't know what's going to happen. But here they come with their ark. And they go around the walls and they don't speak a word. Think about the contrast with the week of creation. What stands out each day in the creation? It's God speaking. God saying something. Let this be. But now there is complete silence. Till we get to day 7. And on day 7, God says, on that day, the day of rest, I am going to take the rest away from this city. And you people of Israel, all you have to do is stand and watch the power of God. And so as God is true to His word, God allows the city to be taken with Joshua in command, but no one being able to escape the fact that God is there with His ark reminding them of who truly gave the victory. And so what do we find then about the obedience of Joshua? We find this is what God says. So the Lord was with Joshua, and His fame was in all of the land. Everybody knows who Joshua is. By the way, that word fame is used only one other time in the book of Joshua. And that's when a group of people who were also scared started talking about the God of the Israelites. And the Gibeonites said, "We're from a far country. Your servants have come because the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard of His fame." Here is God, here is Joshua, both famous in the land of Canaan. Because here we find a humble servant who is exalted by his God and winning that battle. So in these first chapters, the Ark of the Covenant, like it has in every other place, is symbolizing to us that if you are against God, death is going to follow. If you do not glorify God, death is going to follow. But if you do, there will be victory and there will be hope. So in our last few minutes this morning, let's take that for what it's worth. Let's think about the God that we follow. Because even today, we talk about times to come in terms of the promised land. We sing songs where we talk about eternity with God, of going to that land of promise. So we understand that we've taken that and we've used it, that God is going to deliver us to a much bigger and better place than even what we see here in the book of Joshua. What do we have to understand? We have to understand that the only way that we will ever enter that land is by the mighty hand of God. There is nothing within you and I that's going to have the ability to somehow earn our passage into that land. No more than this little ragtag group, the descendants of folks who had come out of the land of Egypt, had the power to take on the Canaanites. They didn't. It was only by the power of God. And so what that means for us is that we must never fail to recognize what God is doing for us. I'd like for you to think about this in terms of what Peter says. Because I think this passage really sums up how Israel was able to take Canaan and how we're going to be able to enter that promised land one day. As Peter says, "Humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God, so at the proper time He may exalt you." There will be no self-exalted person crossing over into eternal rest with God. It's not going to happen. Peter says the only way that you can ever recognize the mighty hand of God is when you humble yourself under it, when you realize who's in charge, when you realize who's the one who's in power. And as the people of Israel realize that, so too must we. And we must recognize that the way this is going to happen is that God is going to defeat evil. Just as He was able to wipe the Egyptians out, just as He was able to wipe the Canaanites out, God can take care of defeating wickedness. That's what the Apostle Paul shares with us, passage that we read from this morning in 1 Corinthians 15. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Not by our power, not by our authority, but by that mighty hand of God that we can be saved. In the account that we've looked at this morning, it was in Joshua that we saw God partnering with a human, just as He had done with Moses. But what we're going to see in this victory is that in Jesus, we see God becoming human, fully God, fully man, coming to earth, living amongst us, demonstrating obedience, taking the curse for us, so that it was not one battle that was won, but the battle that was won, where any who desire the escape of wickedness can find that through Jesus Christ. And so how is that going to happen? Well, same way in a sense that the people of Israel coming out of Egypt, going into the land of Canaan, you and I are also going to pass through the water. As we talked about how that really the first part of Joshua so merges the Red Sea and the Jordan crossing, it's almost like God picturing through that water coming out of Egypt into the land of promise. I understand there were 40 years between that. But it appears that's what Joshua is helping us to see, is that when one trusts God to pass through the water, God can bring out of sin into salvation. The Apostle Paul will pick up on that terminology. As he describes to the Corinthians about their salvation, he says, "I don't want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." Isn't it interesting how he picks up that word baptism? Was it by faith that the people of Israel were saved out of Egypt? It absolutely was. Was it by the grace of God the people of Israel were saved out of Egypt? It absolutely was. Was it by grace and faith that they came into the promised land? It absolutely was. But God said, you got to pass through the water. You got to trust me. That when you're looking at those heaped up waters, you can know that I am the God of your salvation. And I am convinced that's what you and I are to see in the waters of baptism. That we too are passing out of wickedness. That we too are passing in to that rest with God. And when we do that, we can understand then that the battles that we are going to face on a personal level, though God has won the battle over evil, He's still going to help us to fight our battles. There are going to be times when we're going to be hard-pressed to remember that He is the God of all the earth. But yet that's exactly what the Apostle Paul tells us to do. In Acts chapter 17, note the similarity of language when the Apostle says, "The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man." Why is that going to be hard for us to see? Because sometimes that just does not appear to be the case. These are the times that our faith are tested. Even this last week, as our attention so unfortunately has been fixed on terrible events in Uvalde, Texas. Sometimes it's hard to look at that and to say, is the God of all the earth still watching? Or to even look at times in our lives personally where bad things are happening, is the God of all the earth still there for you and me? When darkness prevails, this is when the time of our faith is tested, that God will ultimately prevail over it. Because you know, God's battle strategies aren't quite like ours. I don't remember a single time in American history where a general said, "Now I want you to go to the city and I want you to march around it one time for 6 days. And on the seventh day, you march around it seven times." That's counterintuitive. That's not how you win a battle unless you're fighting for God. But doesn't God give us equally strange instructions? Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. If someone is being ill with you, if somebody's not treating you well, give him something to eat. Give him something to drink. Does that sound like a successful battle strategy? It absolutely does, if you're serving the God of all the earth. Because God says to us, I don't think like you think, but I am the one who can bring you that victory through my Son, Jesus Christ. Though the strategies I give you may be unconventional, I want you to rest assured that you will win the battle if you trust in me. That is a lesson that was seen in coming out of Egypt, in going into Canaan, in taking the city of Jericho, and in our march to our eternal promised land. But as I close this morning, let me show you one very stark difference between the people of God in that day and the people of God now. You remember what was said? Joshua says, there shall be a distance between you and it, the ark, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. But now, as you and I can look over the completed plan of salvation, and we can not only read the prophecies about Jesus, but seeing them fulfilled, and see His death and His resurrection, we don't read words like that. Instead, we read words like this. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take your yoke upon me and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest for your souls. Jesus never says, keep a distance from me. Now, does that mean we're not to glorify Him? It absolutely does not mean that. In fact, even more so that we can see this magnificent plan enacted. But now Jesus says, I want you near. Because I have come. I have taken on humanity. And I understand what you're going through. And I understand the power of temptation. And I stand every day interceding on behalf of humanity. And I want you to trust me that in me you can find salvation. And Lord willing, next week we'll bring all this study to a close by talking about how we see Jesus every step of the way in the Ark of the Covenant. Thank you for your very good attention this morning. And as we close this morning, as we do by tradition, we want to give the opportunity for anyone who's ready to make that commitment to Jesus Christ to pass through the waters this morning, if you've never done that. If you understand that through baptism, this is where you're going to find the grace and the faith in God meeting your trust and confidence, then this morning you're ready to become a Christian, to pass from wickedness into righteousness on your way to the promised land. If things have gotten difficult and you've allowed times of those difficulties to weaken your faith, Jesus still says, come to me. You're laboring, heavy laden, and I will give you rest. If you need to respond to His gracious invitation this morning, won't you come as we stand and sing together?